Like many of you, I've been watching the Olympic Games. The facilities are phenomenal, and the athletes are breaking world records left and right. What I'm trying to say is that from my couch, the Olympics look pretty impressive. And this got me wondering, has it always been this way? We of course know the story of the Greeks founding the Olympics, but what about its modern roots? Well, as it turns out, there have been many undertakings to institute a modern Olympic Games in the last few centuries. Today, we're lucky enough to speak to curator Eric Gentsch to learn more.
They tried the Olympic Games in a number of places, or a type of an Olympic game in different places, such as England, Greece, France. And it wasn't until this man, whose name I will only say once, Baron Pierre de Corbetan, sorry, all you kids studying French, I'll mangle that he created the first International Olympic Committee, which started the Olympics that we know of today, and their first event was held in Greece in 1896.
As Eric said, the man behind the games was Pierre de Coubertin, an energetic Frenchman who leveraged his social circle to create the first of the games. However, it was no easy task, but he did have something on his side.
During this time period, a lot of the Western countries, which we think of as Europe and America, were sort of colonizing the rest of the world, and they were really interested in finding a common base. And what they decided on was Greece, Greece being the founder of what they saw as the civilized world. So they were really looking into the history of Greece and its peoples, and part of Greek history was a ritual called the Olympic Games, and there was a desire to recreate those games to sort of revitalize the Western world.
Now, the ancient Greek Olympics were just for Greeks, though Romans were eventually allowed to participate. So why was it that the modern Olympics had an international aspect to them? Why were they an international event?
One, I guess, would be a connection between all these countries who are traditionally at war. And another would be kind of separating themselves from other nations. Like Europe thought and America thought of itself as a civilized world, and they looked at it as Africa and Asia as being sort of exotic and primitive. So they wanted to kind of bring everyone together, both to see how they were as a country, but also to highlight how superior they were.
Not only was this something that people were interested in, it was also something that was possible. This was an era that saw the transatlantic telegraph cable, improved transportation, and a larger press. This essentially created a world audience wanting to know what other nations were up to, including public sporting events. But the games themselves were not a huge event the same way as we know them today.
No, they weren't big at all. In fact, a lot of people thought they wouldn't succeed at all. The first games in 1896 only had 13 countries represented and 9 sports. The following Olympics were held in 1900 in Paris. And because they were trying to get a little more juice for the games, try to make sure that they were successful, they had the Olympics coincide with this big event called the International Universal Exposition.
The 1900 Olympic Games at the World's Fair in Paris turned out to be far less successful than the 1896 Greek Olympics. Eric, why was that?
Well, the main thing is to a modern scholar, they're very confusing because both lasted for months as to coincide with the fair. So it's hard to know which events at the fair were considered Olympics and which were considered other parts of this exposition.
The sheer length of the event led to the need to fill up some time. I suspect that many of you were unaware that some of these were actually Olympic events. Ballooning, firefighting, tug of war, car racing, motorboating, croquet, falconry, cricket, fishing, live pigeon shooting, and a few lawn games. In short, the World's Fair completely overshadowed the Olympics, to the extent that some people who competed were surprised to find out later that they had actually competed in the Olympics. 4 years later, in St. Louis, the games were again a part of a World's Fair. As in Paris, this led to similar issues in length and diversity of athletes.
It was very expensive to travel. So when the Olympics were held in Paris, it drew mostly from the other countries in Europe. And when they were held in America, it was far and away an American competition. In fact, over 430 of the 500-some competitors were American in 1904.
As you can imagine, this often led to very one-sided victories. In St. Louis, the United States won 70 gold medals, 75 silver medals, and 64 bronze medals. The next closest, Cuba, with 5 gold, 2 silver, and 3 bronze. Interestingly, this was the first time that gold, silver, and bronze medals were awarded for first, second, and third place. In the 1896 games, the winner received an olive branch and a silver medal. In the 1900 games, the winner received a cup or trophy. Aside from the one-side victories, the distance of the games, and likely the fact that the St. Louis World's Fair celebrated France's sale of the Louisiana Territory, this led Coubertin to not travel to be a part of the games in 1904.
The St. Louis World's Fair of 1904 is also a commemorative of the 100 years of the Louisiana Purchase. And this is the land deal Thomas Jefferson made with Napoleon that greatly expanded America's frontier. And during this exposition and during these Olympics, there was a real frontier mentality to America's spirit and about being a young, strong country, ready to take on the world, ready to show the way towards, you know, democracy and working hard. And they saw that their athletic success, whether it's true or not, represented American values. So although, even though the Olympics was pretty much full of Americans, it told the public what they wanted to see, that we are really a strong, young nation ready to just go and take over the world.
Were the games impacted as a result of this?
In a very odd way, yes. They had a couple days called the Anthropology Days, in which they had different peoples of the world compete in track and field events, such as pygmies versus Native Americans and people from the Philippines. And all these people were studied to see if they were the equivalent of the so-called, you know, civilized man.
Another aspect of the fair that found its way into the games was its emphasis on progress.
Part of the St. Louis exhibition part of the goal was to scientifically measure progress or find ways to become more progressive, to not just in technology, but also in terms of the human body. So there was a lot of interest in how these athletes performed, what made them perform better, what were their capabilities, and also how they compared to other peoples of the world.
Looking to find ways to improve performance isn't anything new, nor is using drugs to do it. This may have always been controversial, but it wasn't illegal until the 60s. George S. Patton Jr., for example, the man who would become the famous World War II general, trained on a strict diet of salad and raw steak and used opium before his modern pentathlon in the 1912 Olympic Games. We could point to many single instances of Olympic athletes deciding to use performance-enhancing drugs. But what about an Olympic event being used to test them on athletes? Yes, following the fair's theme of progress, this actually happened in the 1904 Olympic event, the marathon, which had been invented for the 1896 games. Many considered this event so long, 26 miles and 385 yards, that it was dangerous to participate in. This is exactly why James Sullivan, the head of the Department of Physical Culture at the fair, thought it would be the perfect testing ground to see how athleticism can be improved through science. To accomplish this, the athletes were measured and tested before the race, and then followed throughout the race by over a dozen motor vehicles carrying doctors, scientists, race officials, and trainers. And it was from these cars that the athletes were experimented on and observed. It's safe to say, however, that this event was anything but scientific. One athlete collapsed a few miles in. Another was sent to the hospital due to severe internal bleeding caused by the breathing in of all the dust that the cars were kicking up. And another participant? Well, he stopped in an orchard during the race and ate what turned out to be a rotten apple. The ensuing stomachache prompted him to lay down and take a nap. Two other participants from the Zulu Kingdom, and these were participants who were quote-unquote on loan from the Ferris Anthropology Department, well, they were chased off the course by dogs. The eventual winner was hallucinating when he was literally carried across the finish line by race officials. What had been done to increase his performance before that? Well, he was purposefully dehydrated, given a sponge bath with hot water. He was given egg whites to eat, French brandy to drink, and strychnine, a poison that stimulates your body in small doses. Pretty impressive that he finished it all, if you ask me. And the runner who took the nap, you may ask? Well, he just missed the bronze and finished in fourth place. To read the whole story, check out the Smithsonian Magazine blog article, "The 1904 Olympic Marathon May Have Been the Strangest Ever." I agree. Clearly, the early Olympic Games were very different from the heavily regulated and colossal games we know today. Some of what we learned may be initially surprising, but when we think about the themes and issues at that point in history, we can start to make sense of it. Most of it, that is. Now it's your turn. Take a look at the beginnings of some big event or institution in our society. There's a good chance that you'll be surprised and not only learn a lot about that event or institution, but also about the themes and issues of that time period. This is Matt Hoffman for the History Explorer podcast. I want to thank you for listening and curator Eric Gentsch for taking the time to speak with us. The History Explorer podcast is funded from a generous grant from the Verizon Foundation. Music from the Underscore Orchestra's album, No Money, No Honey, All We Got Is Us. You can find this at creativecommons.org.